Okay, I'm going to be focusing mainly on some of the recent and preliminary results on large-scale structure from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. Just to remind you what the Sloan Digital Sky Survey is, its basic purpose is to make a map of the local universe in three dimensions over a large volume. And it comprises two surveys, a photometric imaging survey in five bands covering the optical range, which will give us images for on the order of 100 million objects. And from those, from the 100 million, roughly 100 million galaxies, we'll choose roughly the brightest million or so, and I'll talk a little bit later about the or so, galaxies to do follow-up spectroscopy and measure their redshifts. We'll also measure redshifts for on the order of 100,000 quasars and a comparable number of what are called luminous red galaxies that I'll talk about a bit later. These are the institutions involved. This is where we get money. These are some of my collaborators. These are people, there are about 100 of them, who have put in at least the equivalent of 2 years full-time effort on the infrastructure for the project. Not all of these are my former graduate students, but some of them are my former postdocs. This is the originally envisioned survey geometry, basically covering the northern galactic cap for the main part of the survey, and then in the fall, when this region is not accessible, we'll do three scans in the southern sky. The total area that we expect to cover by the end of the survey is about 6,600 square degrees of footprint imaging. The north and the south will be of comparable depth, except for the central southern slice, which will be scanned repeatedly in the fall months to look both for transient phenomena like supernovae, for example, and also when co-added, this central slice will go somewhere between 1 and 2 magnitudes deeper than the other ones. I don't want to bore you with hardware and software discussion. So this is we're using a dedicated 2.5 meter telescope at Apache Point Observatory in southern New Mexico. That's the telescope. The photometric survey is being done with this, for the time, very large CCD camera, an array of 30 primary CCD chips. It's used in drift scan mode, so a given point on the sky drifts sequentially through 5 different filters, 5 different CCDs, and therefore we get nearly simultaneous imaging of each part of the sky in 5 different passbands. Using this drift scan technique. And you'll notice that there are little gaps between the columns of the CCDs. And so in a given night, we drift scan, and we sort of makes a child's finger painting smear across the sky. And then sometime soon thereafter, we interleave that with another child's finger painting, which overlaps them to get a contiguous area of coverage. This is the filter response of the 5 optical filters for the imaging camera covers most of the optical passbands. And so what we do is we make images like this. This is a very small part, an atypical part of a long drift scan. And then we go in and say, yeah, we want to measure redshifts of all these things. So we mark them. And then we drill metal plug plates with holes at the points where we want to measure all those redshifts. And then we plug those plates, and we can measure spectra for, we can measure spectra for 640 objects at a time, which allows us to do on the order of 1 million galaxy redshifts in 5 years, as opposed to 3,000 years. So it's a good thing. So the survey started in April 2000. That's basically where we said, we're done commissioning. And the survey will run out of money at the end of June in 2005, so that's when we will finish. So far, we've acquired a little bit over 3,000 unique square degrees of five-band imaging, so about 60 million objects that we've detected, and something shy of 400,000 object spectra, that is, which gives us redshifts for galaxies, quasars, and stars. The samples that we've been recently analyzing, and which I'll show you some preliminary results today, cover about 2,500 square degrees of imaging with photometric redshifts for the brighter galaxies, and a sample of roughly 150,000 galaxies that with redshifts that we're analyzing, about 30,000 quasar redshifts, and about 25,000 luminous red galaxy redshifts. This shows the footprint that we've covered so far. So basically, this is in survey coordinates that you don't need to worry about, but this is the northern part of our survey. These are the three southern stripes, now all compressed. This was what we originally were hoping to cover. This, if we covered all of this, it would be 10,000 square degrees. The green shows areas that we've imaged so far. And then this shows you areas where we've done spectroscopy so far. So you'll notice that we've taken spectra from most of the regions that we've imaged. The yellow, this is an old figure, but the yellow shows basically the area that we currently expect to have imaged, and with most of that area having follow-up spectroscopy by June of 2005. So something over 6,000 square degrees, about 600,000 spectra. So that's that. Max showed you this plot on Monday. This is just another projection on the sky of the areas for which we already have spectroscopy. So here's the galactic plane here. Here's the north galactic cap. And then these are our three southern stripes wrapping around the back. So this data will all be public. We're carrying out a series of staged data releases a la COBE. In June of 2001, we had an unscheduled early data release, a premature release of data, so to speak. And that was mostly commissioning data, sort of a goodwill gesture for people to nosh on. And then in January of this coming year, along with MAP, we will be releasing a large amount of data, about 2,800 square degrees of imaging, and something in the order of 200,000 object spectra and associated redshifts. I should say that the pipeline, the latest and greatest version of the imaging pipeline, is just now chewing on this data. And we, within the Sloan collaboration, expect to have that data processed and into our database by, if we're optimistic, mid-November. And then we will selfishly hoard that data for a month and a half before releasing it to you at the beginning of January. That's only a joke in the sixth sense. Okay, so large-scale structure results. The first thing I want to emphasize, and I think Max did a good job of this, is that these results are really the results of a large collaborative effort of people in what we call the large-scale structure working group, and too numerous for me to name, but it's been a true team effort, and I think this surprisingly, this way of doing science has so far at least worked enormously well. So I'll be showing you several things. Angular clustering of galaxies in the photometric survey. And the new thing here is incorporating photometric redshifts in a preliminary way into this analysis of the clustering of galaxies in the imaging data. And this allows us to study clustering by galaxy type, that is color and luminosity, in the imaging data itself. So I'll show you some of our early results on that. Max showed you some power spectrum results from our spectroscopic survey. And so I'll be showing you some, essentially the Fourier transform of that, an independent analysis of the two-point correlation function of galaxies and how they compare, and also preliminary results on clustering in the spectroscopic survey by galaxy type. We have a number of other things in the works: clustering of the luminous red galaxies, clustering of clusters of galaxies, clustering of quasars, clustering in the Lyman alpha forest, higher order correlations beyond the two-point function, and also clustering by spectroscopic type. So all the type differentiation here I'm going to be talking about today is based on photometric properties, but we also have spectroscopic typing of galaxies that have redshifts, and finally clustering of galaxies sorted by stellar mass. Okay, one of the reasons we want to do this is because it's been clear since really the first measures of correlation functions of galaxies that the results depend on what kind of galaxies you're looking at. It's one of the oldest results in this subject. And therefore, if we're trying to get at cosmological parameters or get at the underlying mass distribution, we need to figure out how the clustering of different galaxies relates to each other and to the underlying mass. So in other words, the bias, the relative amplitude of clustering depends on things like color, luminosity, and spectral type, and stellar mass. And to study that in detail, you just need very large numbers of galaxies. This is where I think Sloan is starting to make a real impact. So first, angular clustering of galaxies. This is an effort largely being led by some students and former students and postdocs of Alex Soleil. And so basically the idea here is to, in the imaging sample, we don't have spectroscopic redshifts for these galaxies, but we can use our multiband photometry to get rough photometric estimates for the redshifts. And this is one example of how well that works. So what's being plotted here is the estimated photometric redshift based on the five-band photometry, and taking that photometry with templates for galaxy spectra and using it to infer galaxy luminosity type and redshift, and comparing that for a subsample of galaxies for which we actually have gone out and measured the redshift spectroscopically. And fortunately, this technique works quite well with a rather small dispersion of about 0.03, at least over this redshift range, and for more or less, anyway. So I'm not going to go into details of how this is done. We have several different techniques for estimating photometric redshifts, which are all fairly consistent with each other. So what's been done is we've gone into the imaging data we have, which comprises of the order of 50 million galaxies or so. We select out those brighter than about 21st magnitude in R, that brings that down to about 15 million, just because fainter than this, the photo-Z technique is not as well established, and also because star-galaxy separation becomes a bit more of an issue there, and we haven't yet run our best version of star-galaxy separation on this data. That's now happening. And then when we actually do this for sort of a well-defined area of the sky, we get about 10 million galaxies for which we can derive these photometric redshifts. And that's been then further decomposed into a number of different samples. I'm just today going to focus on samples where the photometric redshift is between 0.1 and 0.3, so we're not going to be studying evolution. We can do that with samples that go to higher redshift. So that gives us about 2.2 million galaxies, which we then divide up into various different samples by absolute magnitude, that is intrinsic luminosity. And so I'll be showing you results for how the clustering depends on luminosity, and that will basically involve this sample and these two samples, so from a relatively, well, not so faint, but relatively faint to relatively bright galaxies. And these are the number of galaxies in those sub-luminosity subsamples. And then in these two luminosity bins, we further subdivide the samples according to color from reddish to bluish. Okay, so this is showing you roughly the imaging area that a mosaic of the imaging area that we're that's being analyzed here. About 2,800 square degrees, we end up with about 2,500 or so, a little bit less, when we cut out mask out regions due to bad seeing, bright stars, and various other sundry things going on. But the main mask is actually due to just regions. Since these are very long scans, which often go on for a few hours, using this drift scan technique, occasionally clouds and things will pass through, and so you'll get regions of the sky where just the seeing becomes worse than our quality control allows, and so we just simply excise those regions. And that's the dominant effect. So when we have that sample, as I mentioned, we break it up into three bins in intrinsic luminosity from faint to bright, and this shows you the angular correlation function of those galaxies, again, between redshifts 0.1 and 0.3 in the fainter bin, the median bin, and the brighter luminosity bin. And again, so what we see is that the amplitude of clustering depends on galaxy luminosity. Again, that's not a new result, but this is a result showing this with samples of a few million galaxies. So that's new. The other thing, as I mentioned, we can do, in addition to breaking up the sample according to luminosity, we can further subdivide the relatively faint, and relatively brighter samples according to colors. Because since we have the measured colors of these galaxies, and with the photometric redshifts, we can convert that to an intrinsic arrest frame color, and then divide the sample from basically blue to red into several bins of intrinsic color. And again, you see that there's a trend of clustering with color, that the correlations of the blue galaxies within a given luminosity bin are relatively smaller than the correlations of the redder galaxies. And you see a similar trend within the bright magnitude slice as well. Luminosity bin as well. So those are just some of those are the main results we've obtained so far with the angular clustering. And of course, this analysis is going along with the fact that while we're doing this, we're also trying to check the quality of this data. And what we found is that the quality is excellent. It's certainly We don't find any statistical problems that really compromise this kind of analysis. And the other thing I want to mention about these angular results, which will become evident in a minute, is that this trend with color and luminosity of the clustering that we see in this relatively deeper angular sample agrees very well in both amplitude and scaling with what we see in the much smaller three-dimensional sample from our spectroscopy. So the next thing we want to do in this game is to extend this technique to higher redshifts using the brighter sample and begin to study the effects of evolution of clustering and also extend it to larger scale structures. So I now want to turn to clustering in the spectroscopic survey, the redshift survey. So Max showed you something like this. This is just a projection of galaxies in the equatorial stripes that we have, about 60,000 of the 150,000 or so that we're currently analyzing. So what you see, you clearly see evidence of large-scale structure here. We like Las Campanas survey, which showed us that there's an end to greatness. We clearly see the same thing here. We don't see structures that extend over the whole scale of the survey. The other thing we've discovered, rather surprisingly, is that there are a lot more galaxies in this part of the sky than in this part. That's yet to be explained. It was just a thicker slice. Don't worry. The other interesting thing about this data is that we're now getting to the point where sort of projecting the data just onto a two-dimensional plane is no longer sufficient because we're now starting to fill in these other slices, as you can see here. And so one of the things we're having to do is develop techniques to visualize this data in three dimensions. So Mark Subarow at the University of Chicago has been doing quite a bit of work to develop visualization techniques. You can, he has tools where you can fly in among these galaxies and correlate it with the imaging data, and it's quite nice. And I think will be, has already been proving useful scientifically in addition to just being neat. So I hope you'll be seeing more of that in the future. So what about the spectroscopic data itself? So this shows the redshift distribution of this spectroscopic sample, again, chosen from about 2,000 square degrees of imaging, so median redshift of about 0.1 or so. And we further knock down the sample. We choose a limited range of intrinsic galaxy luminosity. This is the selection that's used to target these galaxies. Basically, it's a magnitude, roughly magnitude limited sample out to an R prime magnitude of 17.7. And when we do that, we get about 140,000 galaxies. And then for the results I'm going to show you, we knock that down further to about 120,000 by imposing a cutoff at a redshift of about 0.15, so we don't have to worry about evolution. Eventually, we will include evolution in the analysis. So when you do that, you then go out and measure the two-point correlation function of redshift space, and this is what we find for that sample of 120,000 galaxies. And when Max takes his power spectrum and does a Fourier transform, he gets this purple line. And so you see that we've discovered that we know how to work in both real space and Fourier space simultaneously. So that's very good. These results agree with each other. So Fourier was right. That's great. But of course, there's information there's quite a bit of information in the redshift space correlation function as shown in this cartoon. Basically, structures in real space on large scales tend to get squashed perpendicular to the line of sight just by infall along the line of sight. Whereas on small scales, you have you enter dense regions which have high virial velocities, and that tends to stretch objects out along the line of sight in redshift space. And so by studying the anisotropy of clustering in redshift space, that gives us a handle on what the velocity field is doing as a function of scale, and that since the velocity field is related to the density field through omega, this in principle gives one a way to estimate the density of the universe. So the standard way that's done is to plot the two-point correlation function as a function of separation perpendicular to and along the line of sight. So these are contours of the correlation function amplitude. Here's unity going up linearly from unity here, and then stepping down logarithmically to smaller amplitudes. And what you see is that the correlation function is enhanced along the line of sight. So this is this finger of God effect predominantly due to virialized motions in dense systems like clusters. And then you also see an extension perpendicular to the line of sight on large scales at small amplitudes where you're approaching this linear infall regime. And so there's information in these distortions. And so one way to pull out that information is to just decompose this two-point function of redshift space into essentially spherical harmonics, and then to look at a certain ratio of the quadrupole to the monopole. And this ratio Q on large enough scales should eventually approach a constant, and that constant is related to this factor beta, omega to the matter to the 0.6 over the bias factor. So if we can see a plateau out here, we can in principle get a measurement of beta, and this data suggests that beta is about 0.4, so we haven't done yet a precise analysis of this, but it's certainly consistent with what the 2-degree field survey reported last year with a beta of about 0.43. The other thing to do, of course, is once you've extracted that information is to then get rid of it by integrating the correlation function along the line of sight. And that gives you a quantity which we call W, which is traditionally called W sub P, which is essentially related by an overall amplitude, more or less, to the real spatial correlation function. So this allows us to measure the correlation length and the slope of clustering. And you see that in real space, the correlation is a very nice power law over at least a couple of orders of magnitude and scale. So again, this is not a new result by itself, but the error bars are pretty tiny. So the other thing, Max showed you this, that we've done, is to divide that redshift space sample by luminosity, just the way we did for the photometric sample. So this shows you the redshift range is essentially corresponding to, I think it's 7 different samples in luminosity from bright out here to intrinsically faint galaxies over here. And we construct these volume-limited samples to analyze. Max showed you how those galaxies of differing luminosities were distributed. Again, this is just along the equator. And he also showed you what the power spectrum for those different luminosity bins looked like. And this is what the two-point correlation function in real space for those same luminosity bins looks like. And unfortunately, we haven't converged on a coherent color scheme yet. So these colors correspond to this, these colors over there, but don't mix and match. But anyway, what we see in both of these cases is generally just an overall offset of the amplitude with luminosity. That is, you can basically scale up from the faint to the bright correlation function just by a simple overall constant bias factor. And this kind of scaling is completely consistent with what we saw in the angular data, which went significantly deeper. So you can use that to effectively pull out a bias factor as a function of scale. And this is shown here. The purple line here shows the results that the 2DF survey had found, a fit to their results for luminosity bias. So the results are fairly, although not exactly, fairly similar, although not exactly. It's not surprising that there would be some offset here, because the 2DF survey is predominantly selecting blue galaxies, selected in blue magnitude, whereas the Sloan we're selecting in a redder band. So we have a different mix of galaxy populations in these two surveys. So what we've further done, which I think you haven't seen before, is also subdivided the sample not only by luminosity, but also by color. And so we now have a number of different subsamples, bright red, faint red, bright blue, faint blue samples. And so we can study how the clustering amplitude evolves both with luminosity and with color. So if we make no luminosity cut, you get this kind of diagram for the contours of the two-point correlation function. So the red galaxies, again, show this very pronounced finger of God effect. You don't see that in the blue galaxies, and this is nothing surprising. It's just due to the fact that the blue galaxies tend to be relatively underrepresented in dense regions like clusters compared to red galaxies. That's just the morphology density relation. But it's nice to see it reflected in this statistic. And again, we can look at the relative amplitude of clustering by color now, and we see again similar trends to what we saw in the imaging data. Unlike the case with luminosity, in color you don't just get a constant shift, but from as you change color, you get a change in the slope as well. And you get that change of slope even within a given band of luminosity. And so you can then start to, since we have enough galaxies in this sample, you can actually start to look at the effects of luminosity bias for both blue and red galaxies separately. And what we see is that, at least for blue galaxies, we see a very simple, again, nearly linear trend of the amplitude with clustering. With red galaxies, the trend is a little bit more obscure. I think a simpler way to see what's going on is to, again, do the same thing, but now divide by some fiducial clustering amplitude. So this shows the trend from faint to bright galaxies for all galaxies, and now from faint to bright in both the blue and the red subsamples separately. And what you see is something that may be a little bit surprising. For example, here on relatively small scales, the faint red galaxies are actually more strongly clustered, perhaps, than the bright red galaxies. This is a trend, again, it's certainly sort of marginal statistical significance, but it was something that was seen by the 2DF as well. So you can make this same kind of plot of bias as a function of luminosity, but we can now do it separately for the red and the blue galaxies. And when we do that, we find that for our blue galaxy trend actually follows what 2DF saw even more closely than if we look at all the galaxies. Again, that's not surprising since our blue galaxy population is probably somewhat closer to the mix that 2DF sees than our total galaxy population. Whereas for the red galaxies, which are these red dots, we see very little, much weaker trend, if any, of bias with luminosity. So this makes it somewhat surprising that when you look at all galaxies just by luminosity, that you see this very nice, simple linear bias, because you don't see that once you subdivide the sample by color. So it appears that as you go from faint to bright galaxies, since we're mixing galaxies of different colors in different ways when we go from faint to bright, there seems to be a bit of a conspiracy that goes into making this very nice constant bias when you just look at galaxies separated by luminosity alone. I just want to mention a couple of things in the negative time remaining. Max showed you this plot of results from the power spectrum. Blue is for our main galaxy sample that I've been talking about. We're also now analyzing this luminous red galaxy sample, which is selected based on color. And this will be, in principle, a very nice sample because it covers a large enough volume that it actually, the amplitude for clustering that you find actually depends in a significant way on cosmology. And so it may be that we'll be able to get some constraint on cosmological parameters by looking at the clustering of these luminous red galaxies. So this is just a forecast for the kind of constraints we may be able to obtain with the full Sloan survey analyzing the luminous red galaxy sample. And finally, just a sort of potpourri of things that you should also be looking out for. We can, of course, look at the clustering of quasars. This is just a preliminary analysis of the two-point correlation function for quasars in our sample. This is a very old analysis. We'll be updating this. Of course, something close to my heart is to go beyond two-point statistics and to measure higher-order correlations, because that tells us about the coherence of spatial structures, the non-Gaussianity of spatial structures. So in the Sloan, we've measured the angular skewness and kurtosis for our early data last year, and we're now in the process of extending this to our larger samples that we have in hand. Okay, and I think I will stop there. Yes, I will stop there. Thanks.
So Matsubara is a lay plot that you showed. So the bright red galaxies, you say, you can constrain omega matter and omega lambda?
In principle. It's essentially... Right, so he was asking, how can you constrain omega matter and omega lambda with the bright red galaxies? So it's essentially looking at the geometrical distortion of clustering in redshift space. And the point is that when you cover a large enough volume, those distortions are sensitive to how you measure distances. Yes. So we have I think four pretty strong candidate gravitational lenses that we've found so far. This was the first one we found. The problem with finding lenses in Sloan is that this is what a lens looks like, a Tegbo lens looks like in our imaging data in the five different pass bands. This is what it looks like at a telescope at a really good site, namely Magellan, where you can get half arc second seeing, and you can clearly separate the two quasar images. And then you can go and take spectra, and indeed it looks, you know, this is the spectra of those two images, and it looks like it's a quasar pair at a redshift of 1.1. The spectra are similar enough that this is very likely to be a lens, and then we do follow-up near-infrared imaging to see if we can find the lensing galaxy. So we've done that, and we have at least four good cases. Here's another case where, again, with Magellan, you can clearly separate three bright quasar images. And in the I band, we even see this fluff, which is from the galaxy, which you don't see in the blue. But again, you know, this is what it looks like in our imaging. And so it's a real challenge to sort of find these things in our imaging and say, yeah, this is likely to be a lens. We have to basically go in and run specialized deep blending algorithms to find these things. We now have about four of these. We're now currently sort of running a concerted campaign to look at our southern equatorial stripe this fall. And so we've run this kind of deep blending algorithm on all our imaging there for things where we know that there's at least one quasar there. And then we've just done a Magellan snapshot survey of all those. And then we'll follow up the most promising of those with spectroscopy, probably at Keck. So we're on the way. We've got a handful now, but it's slow going.
Do you have any constraints on neutrino masses from the large-scale structure at
all? No, there was a rumor to that effect based on a casual talk that was given at Fermilab, but that was way too premature. I think Chris Miller will be showing you what you're referring to is, in principle, by counting clusters of galaxies as a function of mass, you get some constraint on cosmological parameters. But we're still in the early days of trying to understand how we're selecting those clusters and comparing them with n-body simulations to try to see if we can pull out those parameters. But there was, yeah, so don't believe everything you read on certain websites.
Well, let's thank Josh again.